Good afternoon and welcome to the House Special Committee on Energy. The meeting of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:06 on Thursday, May 8th. Members present are Representative Rauscher, Representative Costello, Co-Chair Mears, and Co-Chair Holland. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence their cell phones. I'll also note that we're allowing the use of electronic devices during committee meetings. Just a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Shana Kilcoyne, up here in the front, and she will take care of it. And importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary, and Zach Lawhorn in the back from the Juno LAO for the technology and teleconferencing support. On Tuesday, we heard from presenters who shared their progress on projects and prospects for Alaska's energy future, from oil, gas, and minerals to offshore wind, geothermal, and hydrogen. We'll continue that conversation today with two more presentations. Our first presenter is Kelly Rogers. He is the Marine Energy Program Manager with the National Hydropower Association. And Ms. Rogers, if you're available, you can begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon to the co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and for your attention to Marine Energy's ability to ensure Alaska's strong energy future. I'm honored to be here today to talk about the value of marine energy technologies and the role they can play in advancing energy security, economic development, and community resilience in Alaska. Moving to slide two, the National Hydropower Association, or NHA, represents and champions water power in all its forms, which includes hydropower, pump storage hydropower, and marine energy. In Alaska, hydropower is a well-established pillar of the energy system. It has provided reliable, affordable electricity to communities and industries across the state for decades. And it's a powerful reminder that the movement of water is not just a force of nature, it's a vital source of energy. We believe marine energy can complement and expand that legacy. These technologies are being validated in the market as we speak, and they can build on Alaska's long history of development of water power. I lead NHA's Marine Energy Council, which is a dedicated forum of companies, university researchers, and developers focused on advancing marine energy technologies. This council exists to ensure that marine energy is included in national clean energy policy conversations, and increasingly, state-level discussions too. Hydropower has been specifically recognized in recent executive orders advancing U.S. energy independence and reliability, including the Unleashing American Energy and National Energy Emergency Orders. One of those orders even calls out the kinetic movement of water as a priority area for energy innovation. That language is a clear signal. The federal government sees marine energy as a serious contributor to our national energy future. The president has called hydropower fantastic, and this renewed attention is translating into real policy efforts to support the sector's continued growth. Alaska's congressional delegation is playing a key role in that as well. Senators Murkowski and Sullivan have been tireless advocates for the hydropower investment tax credit, which would support safety and infrastructure upgrades across the existing hydropower fleet. And we're already seeing strong interest from Congressman Begich in working with the industry. This kind of federal momentum creates a unique opportunity for Alaska. You are well positioned not just to benefit from these efforts, but to lead, especially when it comes to the development and deployment of marine energy technologies. So, why is NHA here to discuss Alaska and the Cook Inlet energy future? The answer is simple. Alaska has risen to the top in our analysis of states with strong marine energy potential, local support, and the right moment to commit to these resources with strategic policy actions. No other state in the United States is better positioned to move marine energy from potential to practical. Moving to slide three. As background, marine energy refers to power generated from the motion of water, such as waves, tides, ocean currents, and free-flowing rivers and streams. This is a significant untapped renewable diverse resource around the country. The U.S. Department of Energy has conducted numerical analyses showing that marine energy resources could supply nearly 60% of the total nation's electricity needs if that technical resource potential was fully developed. Marine energy technologies offer numerous benefits to grids, whether those be distributed, micro, or utility scales. Its strength lies in its predictability and year-round availability. The tides come in and out like clockwork, waves roll whether it's sunny or not. That regularity makes marine energy a reliable contributor to a baseload and firm renewable power. And while the long-term vision includes utility-scale generation, marine energy also has immediate value for off-grid applications, including national defense, offshore industries, and communities that currently rely on diesel. Importantly, Alaska has some of the best marine energy potential in the country. The state is on the verge of leading the U.S. in actual marine energy project deployments, and perhaps most exciting, Alaska has the kind of resource strength that could support utility-scale marine energy generation. Moving to slide 4. I would like to highlight a few key marine energy activities that show research is ongoing and validation of these technologies is occurring at home and across the globe. Naturally, let's start in Alaska. In 2024, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory conducted research finding that the existing rail belt grid could support 200 megawatts of tidal energy. This research provides credible quantitative backing showing that Alaska has robust tidal energy potential and the current grid can integrate this resource without overhauling its infrastructure. Next, the University of Alaska Fairbanks and its Pacific Marine Energy Center partners are conducting crucial research and ongoing monitoring in support of marine energy technologies while training the future marine energy workforce. Finally, in Alaska, companies are coming into the state to explore projects in wave, tidal, and river current technologies, with a majority being U.S.-based. Foreign companies are starting to come and explore the market. This shows that Alaska has the eye of the marine energy sector, and Alaska could become a national leader with the right policy support to continue advancing these technologies. Across the lower 48 and Hawaii, test sites like PacWave in Oregon, the Wave Energy Test Site in Hawaii, and others are giving companies a place to further validate their technologies. The Cal Poly Pier was recently approved to be a test site, and it would be could be hosting devices very soon that would be validated for national defense applications, further demonstrating the validity of these technologies for a variety of use cases. And over the past few years, multiple demonstration projects have been completed and others are planned, many of which have been supported by the Department of Energy's Water Power Technologies Office. Looking internationally, in Canada, a grid-connected tidal project was operating in the Bay of Fundy. In the United Kingdom, developers will be delivering tidal power directly to market through a contracts for difference market scheme. And across Europe, technologies are starting to transition from commercialization to industrialization, leading the world in marine energy advancement. Alaska can take inspiration and potentially leadership by supporting similar progress in your state. And moving to slide 5. Now that I've discussed the broad landscape for marine energy, I'd like to focus on what makes Alaska uniquely positioned to lead in this space. Simply put, Alaska doesn't just have one marine energy resource, it has them all. And each one aligns with real-world energy needs across the state. To start, Alaska has more than 100 remote communities that rely on imported diesel for electricity, often at high cost and with significant vulnerability to supply disruptions. For these communities, marine energy, whether tidal, wave, or river-based, can provide a locally generated, clean, and highly predictable alternative. That predictability is key because it means fewer blackouts, more stable microgrids, and greater community control over energy. In South Central Alaska, the Cook Inlet stands out as one of the most energetic tidal resources in North America. Knowing the energetic nature of the Cook Inlet, it offers a utility-scale opportunity, not just for powering individual communities, but potentially feeding power directly into the broader grid. This is a rare and valuable resource nationally, and it gives Alaska a chance to lead in developing large-scale tidal energy that could serve both local and industrial loads. Along Alaska's southern coast, the Gulf of Alaska sees consistent and powerful wave activity. The sheer length of Alaska's coastline means that there's a vast stretch of geography that could support distributed, small-scale wave energy systems near fish processing facilities, ports, or other coastal operations. Wave energy is compelling because it can be deployed modularly, and the technology is steadily maturing thanks to test sites that I mentioned before. And inland, Alaska's free-flowing rivers offer significant potential for riverine hydrokinetic energy. These technologies don't require dams or diversions. Instead, they can be installed directly in the flow, delivering power to communities that are far from transmission lines. So this variety means that Alaska isn't limited by geography or resource type. It can support multiple marine energy technologies, each suited to different local needs and scales, from individual villages to regional grid supply. Whether the goal is cost savings, resilience, or decarbonization, Alaska has the natural energy to do it, as you all know, and you have the opportunity to show the rest of the country how it's done. Moving to slide 6. Marine energy's benefits to Alaska go beyond simply adding more clean energy to the mix. Alaska's geography, economy, and existing energy challenges make marine energy not just viable, but strategically important. First, marine energy is available year-round. That's a rare and valuable trait among renewable energy resources. In a place like Alaska, where solar is highly seasonal and wind can be variable, having a renewable source that is predictable and consistent throughout the year is vital. It is a valuable firming resource that is regular and dependable, making it a vital piece to a baseload always-on grid. Second, as Alaska looks to diversify and expand its economy, marine energy is well positioned to support emerging energy-intensive sectors. These include data centers, critical mineral processing facilities, offshore oil and gas operations, all of which require substantial and steady power supplies. Marine energy offers a way to meet that demand. And third, the economic development potential of a marine energy sector in Alaska is substantial. Building this industry here would mean Alaska-based jobs in engineering design, maritime construction, vessel services, system installation, and long-term operations and maintenance. It also aligns with Alaska's existing strengths in marine trades and offshore expertise. In other words, this isn't about building something from scratch. It's about adapting and expanding existing skill sets into a new and growing clean energy market. Taken together, these benefits position marine energy not just as a clean power solution, but as a tool for job creation, resilience, and long-term energy sovereignty. Moving to slide 7. While I focused on the practical benefits of marine energy, from job creation to grid reliability, it's equally important to emphasize how these outcomes align with Alaska's broader energy and policy goals. First, it advances energy independence. As I mentioned before, these technologies can aid in reducing reliance on imported diesel, which has long been a priority for you and your state. Second, marine energy fosters economic resilience. By investing in a local place-based energy industry, Alaska can develop a robust energy economy that isn't tied to a boom and bust commodity cycle. A thriving marine energy sector would support skilled jobs, local businesses, and innovation hubs, all while keeping more dollars in the energy sector circulating within the state. Third, marine energy enhances long-term diversification, both for energy and the economy. Diversification is a key theme in Alaska's energy planning, and marine energy offers a way to expand the state's energy mix with a technology that complements other renewables. It can help reduce volatility in energy prices over time, especially as global fossil fuel markets continue to shift. As more institutions and industries seek low-carbon energy sources, Alaska has an opportunity to position marine energy as a part of that supply. In short, marine energy is not a silver bullet, but it is a highly strategic fit for the challenges and goals Alaska has already outlined. With the right support, it can reinforce the state's leadership in energy innovation while delivering meaningful results for Alaskans. And moving to slide 8. Other regions, both internationally and here in the United States, have begun recognizing the value of marine energy and are taking deliberate policy steps to support its advancement. For example, in the United Kingdom, a program that I mentioned before called the Contracts for Difference, it guarantees a fixed price for marine energy over a set period of time. This approach gives developers a predictable revenue stream, which is crucial for early stage technologies that need to attract private investment and scale. This market mechanism has helped unlock tidal energy projects that will deliver power to the grid. In Nova Scotia, the province introduced a feed-in tariff specifically for tidal energy. That means developers receive a premium rate for the electricity they produce, giving them a clear path to recover costs and demonstrate technology in real-world conditions. Nova Scotia has since seen multiple deployments of in-water systems. Here in the United States, both California and Oregon are proactively integrating marine energy into their broader offshore energy and climate planning efforts. That includes mapping marine energy resources, supporting permitting coordination, and building the infrastructure needed to host future projects. What these examples make clear is that policy signals matter. Early stage industries don't scale without intentional support, and marine energy is no exception. These are not one-size-fits-all solutions, but they do provide a menu of proven tools that Alaska could consider. And moving to slide 9. To realize the robust opportunities I've discussed today, Alaska doesn't need to reinvent the wheel, just needs to take a few targeted near-term steps to signal that marine energy is a state priority. These actions would create the conditions for investment, innovation, and successful deployment. First, the state could explore policy mechanisms designed to create a market pool, such as procurement targets or early stage power purchase agreements. These kinds of tools give developers and investors confidence that Alaska is serious about marine energy and that there will be a pathway to sell the power they generate. Second, Alaska can ensure that infrastructure planning incorporates marine energy from the beginning, not just as an afterthought as some other places have done. That includes integrating marine energy into plans for coastal microgrids, evaluating port capabilities for deploying and maintaining marine devices, and identifying transmission needs for grid-connected projects like those possible in the Cook Inlet. Third, the state can convene a dedicated working group made up of policymakers, communities, developers, researchers, to evaluate how marine energy fits into your state goals. This group can identify priority sites, recommend incentive structures, and align agency efforts. Finally, Alaska can support a small number of strategic demonstration projects, particularly in communities where diesel dependence is highest. These early deployments will provide real-world data, community experience, and public visibility that can drive future investment and scale. These are not high-cost or high-risk steps, but they are high-impact. Taken together, they could position Alaska as a national and global leader in marine energy innovation and deployment while delivering real benefits to Alaskan communities. And then my last slide, 10. I just want to close by saying thank you again for the opportunity to present today, co-chairs and members of the committee. I hope this briefing helps demonstrate that marine energy isn't just a long-term opportunity ripe for investment and focus from the state. It's a near-term strategy for Alaska's communities, economy, and energy present. I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee or provide further information in written format after this meeting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Rogers. That was really helpful to frame some of the broader context of this. We have a couple questions coming up. We'll start off with Representative Rauscher.
Yep. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Through the chair. So I appreciate the presentation. It was very good. I did a great job. So I was looking back on page 7, and I highlighted skilled jobs. And I was just wondering, and this is not speaking against anything, this is speaking to understand, are the skills so specialized that it's hard to find candidates with the expertise to apply? And so I'm just trying to understand, because he did call out skilled jobs, I'm just trying to understand the skill level.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, thank you for that question. The skilled labor, there are certain jobs that, like marine energy programs at different universities, they are training these individuals to get ready for these types of jobs. But there are also jobs that the expertise is transferable. So we do see engineers coming over from, you know, the wind sector or even the hydropower sector coming over to the marine energy sector. So the electrical engineering jobs, for example, those are transferable, but there are some that are a little bit more specialized, that there are programs at universities like University of Alaska Fairbanks that are pursuing that training.
A quick follow-up. And are the kids taking advantage of these now, these classes that offer these types of skills, and to what degree are they taking the advantage of?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, there is a great program called the Marine Energy Collegiate Competition that was put up by the Department of Energy's Water Power Technologies Office that created teams for students to kind of like, you know, win a prize at the end. And I can get this information to you after the hearing with the exact numbers, but those are very favorable programs when they're at the universities. So I know some of the programs are always looking for more students, as I think a lot of the more specialized training ones are, but there is different clubs and opportunities for them to dive into marine energy a bit more.
And then one last follow-up, the pay level in this kind of an area of, is it a very good pay level for those kids to chase after?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I don't know if I am the best equipped to answer that question right now. Our next presenter may comes from a private company. Maybe he'll have a little bit more insight into that one.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Ms. Rogers. I have a couple of questions. One of them is, I really appreciate that you called out that there's a lot of small communities in Alaska that are relying on imported diesel and the desire to get off of that. One of the challenges we have in Alaska, not only in small communities that could have populations of a few dozen or a few hundred, but also our industrial, like our main population corridor, is got some limited demand. Could you talk a little bit about scale of projects and like how the size of something that need that is economically feasible?
Through the chair, thank you, Co-Chair Mears. For the Cook Inlet, for example, there is enough tidal capacity. There's an enormous tidal capacity that could be taken out of the Cook Inlet, not taken out, sorry, that could be harnessed in the Cook Inlet by tidal energy, and that would require arrays of these devices, and it would be more than is the demand in the rail belt. So utilizing that energy to potentially create new, bring in new industries into Alaska. I think you guys heard from hydrogen person the other day. That is a feasible and economical way to utilize any, you know, excess energy coming in from the Cook Inlet because there's so much resource potential out there.
Follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
That's our struggle, is that trying to right-size projects and some of it seems like a, you know, we'll talk about this here shortly, but, you know, like having such energy potential but not having such energy demand makes the projects economically challenging because there's a certain economy of scale that needs to be had that we just don't have. So not only is that true for, you know, South Central and the Rail Belt area, but it's especially true once we get out into small communities that aren't connected to each other and we're trying to we're having to, you know, provide service to folks that, you know, that there's populations of a few dozen to a few hundred. So, you know, getting off of diesel means having other projects that are economically scalable on that level. Part of the struggle here is that the initial investment on renewable projects, the initial capital investment is higher, even though the long-term costs are less because you're not importing the diesel. So it's a trade-off that we make in so many places here in Alaska that we have the lower initial investment and then the higher longer-term operation costs. So I'm hoping that, and maybe it's something for offline and afterwards too, but if there's any examples you can help provide of, for the elimination of the committee, of small scale projects that not just work, but are economically viable.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Mears, I would be happy to follow up with you after the hearing with some more information and provide some of those examples.
Can I follow up?
Thank you. And then I've got one more. As far as through the chair, more examples are always good, especially on the policy end. What policy tools are other jurisdictions using to support the development of industry, you know, especially since we are in an environment that the initial capital costs are larger and the long-term operation costs are less? How do we help get projects over that initial hump and employed? I know there's things that we're working on here as well, but the ways that other jurisdictions are implementing policy to make that happen are also important, because there's lots of folks with lots of different ideas. So finding the ones that work in our circumstance, it helps to have a broad range of examples.
That's not for
right now. Yeah, that's Rogers, for a follow-up. Okay.
If you'd like to comment on that, please do. Otherwise, I think that may be a follow-up.
Yes, yes.
Right. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Just dump all your knowledge on us. That would be great.
There you go.
That's
wonderful.
All.
Thank you. I've got a couple things I wanted to follow on. I think almost related to that, I think I'll begin with a question. In terms of the work that you see being done around the country and perhaps internationally, and as we look ahead at these projects, I'm curious about two areas. One is, are you seeing anything we should be aware of and working on as it relates to the integration of these marine power uses with other issues around navigation or other uses, including fishing or activities that are in the same areas as these power projects? Should we be concerned and looking into any of these issues to make available the framework to ensure compatible use in these areas that maybe have common interest?
Mr. Chair, there has been ongoing research into how marine energy technologies are interacting with their environment. We have data from deployments in the United States and some from Europe and the UK. And it's important that we are using that information, sharing it between jurisdictions, just so that regulators and people who are going and handling the permitting process for these technologies during these initial deployments and demonstrations are able to utilize existing knowledge. And with that, I feel marine energy and this sector is well equipped at learning lessons from other industries. They have seen what has happened with, you know, offshore oil and gas, how those structures have interacted with their environment. Not that the scale of these technologies are that large and they're not doing the same thing, but there are things to be learned from that and from offshore wind. So I feel marine energy companies have taken really great approaches at either adaptive management when going through a licensing process, communicating with the communities, and understanding what uses are going on in the ocean or in the river or in the close to shore area that they want to deploy.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ms. Rogers. I think that dovetails nicely into the second question I wanted to ask, which is, I'm aware that in our land-based renewable projects, we've had some work that we needed to do in our regulatory processes and permitting processes to make it more practical for renewable projects to have access to land that was otherwise permitted for underground oil and gas. And I'm curious, in the case of marine applications, do we have the regulatory framework in place to be able to deal with the leasing needed to support these projects, particularly as we look at some of the navigable water issues that have made the control over those waters questioned over time? Are we okay in terms of the primacy and the regulatory environment, or do we have work that needs to be done in order to create the pathway for these projects to be able to have access to the generation streams and channels or preferred locations that they'd like to be in?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say in the regulatory regime, marine energy, it can be, it's not as familiar with regulators and people who are providing permits. They're more familiar sometimes with oil and gas, wind, or other, you know, energy sources. So that can cause timeline delays, increased costs, and a full marine energy license, actually, within the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it is a hydropower license, a conventional hydro license. So I feel that the regulatory environment could be streamlined and a full license could look different for marine energy, maybe one day. And in regard to leasing our marine energy projects, they would go through BOEM for a potential offshore lease. At this time, we do have a BOEM research lease that was given to the PacWave test site, the coast of Oregon. And to my knowledge, and I can follow up with this if people are looking for more information, I believe that's one of the only research leases that has been given for marine energy at this point. So we need to look at, you know, how that process went and how it could be better for the future projects.
Great. Thanks. And just to follow up on that particular question, in the case of a run-a-river on a navigable river body, is BOEM doing that leasing, or does that cross over into the jurisdiction of another entity when we get into run-of-the-river village-type power projects that might be there? I think of BOEM as ocean, but maybe I'm being restrictive in my thinking about their purview.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. BOEM is the ocean, and our in-river technologies would be going through FERC, Army Corps of Engineers, and the whole litany of the regular permitting process for those.
Okay, thank you. The last big question I want to ask, or broader question in terms of policy, is in terms of what's happening these days with federal support for renewable energy projects, is the funding for hydropower projects still available? Is it being paused? Are there concerns about the ability of federal programs to be available for hydropower projects?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's the short answer of it. There has been some pausing in water power money, you know, looking at the R&D money coming out of the Water Power Technologies Office. There is a unique thing about water power, it is very bipartisan at the federal level. We have supporters from both sides of the aisle in both houses. It's very bicameral, bipartisan. And as I said in my opening remarks, the president has expressed support and urging folks to continue the kinetic movement of water, looking into that and making that more available. And we do fit into the President Trump's American energy dominance, because with dominance, it would be abundance. And marine energy would be an additional energy mix item that would create a more abundant energy supply.
Great, thanks. The last question is, I think I'd like to start off with you, but it's actually leading into the next presentation. And you introduced a really interesting concept in one of your slides about making sure that as we work on projects, we look at integrations. And I'm just curious, in the case of the high-voltage DC line that's being proposed to cross Cook Inlet, and as we start looking at Cook Inlet energy projects, I'm wondering if we should be looking at that project with an eye towards its ability to support integration of ocean tidal generated power when we design and implement that project, so that we've actually created the capacity to connect up easily with these other projects. Is there a connection that we should be aware of, and we should be asking AEA as they develop that project to be creating those connection points for future Cook Inlet power generation, or are they different animals in terms of the transmission function of one versus the generation intertie that would be needed for the generation projects?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may defer that question to the next speaker, as he's very ingrained in that topic. I would say that as anybody is planning for future transmission upgrades to the system or any infrastructure that is near the coast, or bringing any offshore energy onto shore, considering and planning for the integration of marine energy is vitally important to making sure these technologies can come online.
Perfect. Thank you, Ms. Rogers. Any other questions for Ms. Rogers right now? Yes, sir. Representative Rauscher?
I appreciate the questions, and Imonic is a very good example of, and I believe they're trying for a second one. It also answers the question that the engineering is possible to work around all interactions with water bodies that are used for all different types of degrees of use, and including fish, which were part of that project. And the Corps of Engineers is in charge of all body that you can traverse, even in a canoe. So I just want you to know that they're basically the entity that they have to deal with there, but there are others. Mm-hmm. And so it's not regulated out to where we can't do it. It's definitely allowable, and it is happening in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you. Good. Thank you, Ms. Rogers, for being here, for your presentation, and the continued follow-up that I hope we'll have from you and these projects in the future. Continuing on, our next presenter is Doug Johnson. He is the Director of Development for Ocean Renewable Power Company. Mr. Johnson, thank you for being here in person. It's been good to see you. You may approach the stand and begin your presentation.
Yeah, we start, for the record, Doug Johnson. I'm the Director of Development for Ocean Renewable Power Company here in Alaska. And first of all, I want to say thank you to co-chairs Mears and Holland and all committee members for the invitation to present today and talk to you a little bit about what we think is a very exciting project in one of the most premier tidal energy sites in the world. As we look at this project, it's really quite interesting. You'll note on the title, the American Tidal Energy Project. And this really is an opportunity for us to really look at energy dominance, because we have this amazing resource right at our, literally at our front door, for particularly those that live in South Central Alaska. I've been working on this project now since basically 2006, when I first helped bring Ocean Renewable Power Company to Alaska as the first sweat equity investor. I was looking at converting the platforms in the inlet, the oil platforms in the inlet, to perpetual energy platforms with wind up tops, submarine turbines in the end. And I found this company that was in its nascency called Ocean Renewable Power Company. And we really found each other and brought them to Alaska. And so we've been out at this now for quite some time. As we move forward with this presentation, I'm really, first of all, just happy to be here today, because there's so many things to talk about, and I hope we have an opportunity for a really great and robust conversation. Just a little bit about the company. As I said, the company was actually founded in 2004. We've been deploying these devices in the water, producing electricity, since 2007. We were the first company to do that in the United States, in the American side of the Bay of Fundy in Cobbs Cook Bay in Maine. And we've now expanded our work. We're operating in four countries at the moment with offices there. And we have interest from over 70 countries around the world, and particularly in our river systems that are currently operating in the community of Igiagig on the Kvijak River. We have two systems operating there just off Lake Iliamna. So a lot of people are looking at that and wanting to know more about it and how that might apply to their regions. So, you know, we're looking at this, we talk about the big picture, and the thing about Cook Inlet, it's one of the most interesting water bodies that we have on the planet for tidal energy. And one of the reasons why that is because of the inlet's configuration, its length, its depth, and how that mass of water moves in and out of the inlet every day, four times a day. It's unique in that there's a lot of places around the world where we have tidal energy, but there's no place that we know of where this unique geometry, if you will, of the inlet combines with extremely high tides. So that's what we're very excited about. And we think there is an opportunity for a world-class tidal energy deployment here in the Cook Inlet. And with that, we've been really fortunate in over the years to partner with many organizations. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, or NREL, I'm on slide four. Sorry, thank you. So on this slide, what we're really highlighting is the resource itself. The red is where the tidal energy is its most abundant, and it's right where the Cook Inlet necks between the East Foreland and West Foreland of Cook Inlet, right at Nikiski, just north of Kenai. And that energy resource has been now characterized, and we're looking at 18 gigawatts of potential energy associated with Cook Inlet right now, which is massive. When we talk about the average load on the rail belt today is somewhere around 600 megawatts, this is multiple times what we have the current load for. So it's an amazing resource. Speeds as fast as 4 meters per second, which is just remarkable. One of the things that how I kind of got into this is I grew up in Anchorage. I was born in Anchorage, grew up there, and I had the good fortune while I was working on my engineering degree at the University of Alaska to actually work in the summers as a surveyor. And I was surveying for Chugach Electric on one of the first submarine cables that went across the inlet. And we were anchored up to a buoy between Karn Point and Point McKenzie, and the tide changed. And we were having lunch, and in 15 minutes, I was in the middle of a raging river, and it was just—I'll never forget that to this day. And that was part of what the impetus for me to get into this. I was still a student at the time, but it's really remarkable. From the shore, you see the tide moving. Tide's moving. You can see the ice moving out. But when you're in that water column and you see that with water, you feel that water moving. It's really quite remarkable. I went on to finish my degree in geological engineering. Major emphasis in geophysics, and got recruited by the oil industry to look for oil and gas. And so that's what I did right out of school. So like many of the other people that you've heard speak on Tuesday, and there's a lot of us that are refugees, if you will, from the oil and gas industry in the old days. I loved the industry. It was extremely good to me as a young person getting right out of school. And I think we can really help that industry as we transition over the time, help that industry be strong as we do make this transition ultimately to renewable energy. And that's why we're so excited about this opportunity in Cook Inlet.
Mr. Johnson, if you could pause for a second, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. I may be jumping ahead through the chair, but when you say 18 gigawatts,
yes.
How many units are we talking about? Since you do have a speed figured out here, you must have some sort of a number of units figured out.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Rauscher, we do. We're not looking to capture a full 18 gigawatts. Let me be very clear about that. We have a clear line of sight to 400 megawatts at this time, and we're looking to having that developed by 2050, 400 megawatts delivered by 2050. The project that I'm talking about right now, the American Tidal Energy Project, is going to deliver a demonstration level at about 2 megawatts. And that electricity should be delivered by 2029, 2030, if we can stay on course. I'll talk a little bit about some of the funding challenges we're facing right now to keep that on course, but that's what we're looking at. And we'll scale from there to tens of megawatts and then ultimately to hundreds of megawatts. But there is absolutely the ability to capture gigawatts of energy out of Cook Inlet, but that's not in our short-term time horizon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's continue.
So kind of where we're at with the fiscal activity associated with this, the phase one which we just completed was a $3 million award, and that basically led us through desktop studies and a real understanding of what it was going to take to make a successful demonstration project here. Concurrent with our work at the East Foreland, another company, Alpauco in Puget Sound, it's Orcas Power and Light in Puget Sound, Washington, is doing a similar project. They were also awarded $3 million. We're in a process right now in DeMarva Energy looking at what they're calling the down select, which will one of the two projects are going to be able to go forward, and that funding will be $29 million. And that gets to the deployment, as I spoke of, for they're asking for 1 to 5 megawatts. We're going to deliver 2 megawatts is our plan because we can. The reason we're doing that is the expense difference between delivering to Homer Electric's grid at distribution level cost as opposed to transmission level cost is significant. So in the demonstration project, we're going to deliver at 2 megawatts. And that time frame for phases 2 through 5, should we be successful in this down select, which we delivered everything on time, perfect to the budget, and we're very hopeful and we're confident that we have a really great project. We just the DOE is going through a lot right now, particularly the Water Power Technologies Office, in terms of what they're able to move forward with or not at the moment, and they're in a major reorganization. So we're standing by. Some of the back channel conversations are looking very favorable, but they have not been able to come get on record to say yes, we're moving forward or not yet. So we're standing by. We're hopeful.
Mr. Johnson, can I ask a question at this point? I'm curious because you mentioned something I think seems like it's important to take a second and look at, particularly from the standpoint of you're essentially going to become an IPP, I assume. And you mentioned the difference between being a distribution supplier versus a transmission supplier, and that made a pretty significant difference in the capitalization of that. Could you unwrap that a little bit more? Because I think there's something important for us to understand in what you're distinguishing there about this project and perhaps other projects in the future that I need to at least understand the significance of what you just said.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Holland, for the question. It's really an important distinction. Ultimately, we will be generating and distributing at or moving electricity at transmission voltages and quantities. But in this demonstration project, we want to keep it at a level that's the most economic for a demonstration. So that's why we're going to be keeping it to 2 megawatts of delivered power. That's and as I get into the presentation, I'll kind of walk you through how that's going to work. And then in the rollout or the development of the project to that full 400 megawatts by 2050, what we're looking at there is that will be a transmission project into the grid, still through Homer Electric, but also, as was pointed out, it's very important for us to have that additional submarine HVDC cable from Bernice Lake over to Beluga. That's critically important to be able to move those electrons north. So that's we're coordinating right now with AEA on that.
Okay, great. Let's continue on. I'm going to keep an eye out on that issue. There's something important hiding in there.
This is just an image of the device that we plan to deploy. We are going to be deploying two devices. This is our technology. It's rather unique in the way that we're working in this project. We are not only the developer of the project, we're also a technology provider. So we've developed this technology that you see in the screen today. This is our TIGEN 80, and in cooking with this device can generate well over 230 to 240 kilowatts at 3.5 meters per second, which cooking inlet peaks at almost 4 meters per second. So we're in a great energetic environment, and this device is designed to optimize power generation in that environment. The other device that we'll be deploying as part of this project is actually a European technology from a company called Proteus, and they have some of the longest runtime in tidal energy of anyone in the world. And we've invited them to be part of this project in that they have demonstrated their excellence and abilities. And also, it's a completely different technology. Our technology is what's called an advanced cross-flow design, and this is what's called an axial flow design, much like what you might consider an underwater wind turbine. And you notice the actual foils there, those are very much, much shorter than you would see on a wind turbine in terms of the blades that you'd see on a wind turbine. And ours are, as you can see, I'll just back up here for a second. You can see ours look more like it's kind of looks almost like it might be a push lawnmower or something. Those aquafoils that we use are literally underwater wings. And that lift that wing produces as the tide flows through it is what produces turns the turbine and produces the electricity. We wouldn't be able to do this project if we didn't have the excellent support of our partners and supporters. And this is just a list to let you know that we are, you know, extremely well supported in this effort. All the green are Alaskan enterprises in one way, shape, or form. So we're really proud to be engaging with so many Alaskan organizations and have so much support for this project from Alaska partners. So just in terms of accomplishments we've made, I guess in phase one, you know, we had 17 deliverables to the Department of Energy. We actually did a draft pilot license, which was a 1,350-page document that had to be delivered to them. That's gone in. It's been received. No red flags on that. We received 20 letters of support from folks around the region, and also Senator Murkowski, and a letter from Governor Dunleavy, who I'm going to be seeing later today to say thank you to him for his support for the project. He's been a real champion for us. And I think we're really in an amazing place for the project at this time. It's going to take a lot to get from where we are to where we want to be, but I think we've done some really solid foundation work, and where we're at today really sets us up for success as we move into the future. And that's really the essence of my presentation. What I'd hope we could do is have a bit of a conversation, and there's going to be some really, I'm sure, great questions. So I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the presentation. So, and I know you probably have it all figured out. And, but I just was wondering, the silt.
Yes.
In the Cook Inlet, when you plant something, it seems to build up around it, almost like it finds a place to stop and deposit. So is that something that's kind of making it a little bit tougher to compensate? And I know from presentations last year, you've already got the fish thing, the mammals, everything all figured out there. But I just wondered about the silt, because it kind of deposits and something's in the road, because it shifts so bad, and bore tides on the fly, you know. Anyway.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, fantastic question. When we started designing the turbine, one of the real questions was, how are we going to address the wear on the bearings and seals? And so what we did is we literally collected Cook Inlet water and took it, and we worked with the University of Alaska's Mechanical Engineering Department, and we built a flume, and we ran those bearings and seals 24/7 to look at wear characteristics, and that's how we landed globally on our diamond bearing sets, is by using Cook Inlet water, which we think is probably the most highly turbid water that you can find, and if we can survive Cook Inlet, we'll be able to survive anywhere. But it's a great question, and kind of the second part of that is, there are, believe it or not, there are dunes, submarine dunes, that are migrating in Cook Inlet. I don't know if you've seen any of the bathymetry, but it's really quite remarkable. So one of the things that we're looking to understand better on why we are using the two technologies is our technology sort of flies mid-water column. It's anchored with and moored in the mid-water column, so it's way off the bottom. But the Proteus turbine is actually going to set on the bottom. And so they might be experiencing they might experience what you're describing as that buildup. We don't think it's going to be problematic, but we are going to be watching that very closely.
Okay,
great question.
Right. And I have to go. I apologize.
Okay. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Good to see you, Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
I've got a couple more questions now. So you'd mentioned earlier about being able or hoping to utilize or planning to utilize the platforms that are out there.
Yes.
Would they be the physical structure that you'd be able to mount either of these off of?
Co-Chair Mears, thank you for the question, because we're actually doing work with Hillcorp today. Hillcorp, of course, has become the primary owner of most of the platforms in the inlet. And back in the day when I first started this, we started with Union, and they actually invited us to Houston. We met with Union Oil about this, the concept that I had really started this on, about doing wind up top submarine turbines around the legs. And then Union left Alaska, and then we started working with Marathon and talked to Marathon about it, and they got very interested in it. And then Marathon sold their platforms, and now we're working with Hillcorp, and Hillcorp is very serious about this opportunity. It's not going to be the primary opportunity for the American Tidal Energy Project. That won't even be anywhere near the platforms, but there is some exploration conversation around how the platforms might be interesting opportunities for these devices to work around. There'd be a great above water junction box for an array of turbines, so you don't have to do your socialization of the devices underwater, which is quite expensive. So there's some really unique use cases that could be developed around those platforms.
Thank you. As a fellow engineer, all these things swirl in the brain, and I try and, you know, of course, one of our first things that we want to do is solve everybody else's technical problems. although, you know, our role here is a little bit more on the policy end. So I had another thought about, are there other things within our electrical systems that need to be in place before this works? And what I'm thinking of is that there is, you know, the ebbs as the tides shift, so that there's peaks and valleys in that. Is there like a certain capacity in battery systems or more traditional hydro that need to be in place in order to balance that out?
Yes, Co-Chair Mears, another really great question. Tidal energy is highly predictable. We can tell you, you know, 50 years from now, once we get our power curves normalized for the flows, we'll be able to tell you exactly to the minute what we're going to be able to produce at a given off a given machine. So that's fantastic. But what you're pointing out is something also really important, and that is that it's a sinusoidal curve. Every 6 hours is changing, and there will be ebbs at each machine, and actually slack, when slack tide's there, the power generation will go down. What we're working on is a concept which we call the Cook Inlet Tidal Energy System, which starts collecting the tidal energy at the basically the mouth of Cook Inlet and runs all the way up into Kinnick Arm and Turnagain Arm. And when you start to overlap those power curves, you see less and less of that slack tide or time. But there will be a need, and the other thing is we really love conventional hydro, because we love to see a reservoir that we can help be filled when we're producing, and they don't have to use that power or that water, I should say. So storage technology is extremely important for us to be successful.
So I understand that, you know, like when a high tide or low tide comes, it comes at different times along a system. So that is what you're saying is going to buffer some of that. So how much does that shorten that those low points? Like, well, an hour or a half an hour?
Co-Chair Mears, it's really important to think about where they're spaced, where the devices will be spaced, how far apart they'll be, and that also has to dovetail with where the resource is, because the resource is not the same as all throughout the inlet. As you saw in that one image, there are places that are much more energetic than others, mm-hmm. So we have to model that and try to create that optimal, try to keep the distance between them so that there's always power production as much as we can in this Cook Inlet Tidal Energy System, but yet optimize the resource that's there. And it is highly concentrated at the Forelands. And it's also highly concentrated up inlet in Kinnick Arm between Cairn Point and Point McKenzie. And there's another really nice concentration in Turnagain Arm. Just as you turn into Turnagain Arm is another really nice concentration. As well as right off of Fire Island at what's called Race Point. And it was called Race Point of Fire Island because the local people, I think it goes all the way back to the indigenous folks that were here before anybody came, that they saw the water racing by very quickly there, just off Fire Island.
Thank you. That's enough for now.
Oh, good. Thanks.
I might want to take another turn after you've had
some. There
we
go. We'll take another bite.
I'm sure you've got one or two.
I've got a couple questions. Thank you. I think build off of the power demand or power production cycle and talk a little bit about what do you see as next steps that we could be taking or opportunities that are developing around the demand to use this power? And I've kind of got two parts to this question. One is, you know, what can we do to be stimulating and creating the demand for this power so mm-hmm. there's something pulling it along to make use of it, particularly to make use of it, understanding that it may be fluctuating depending upon whether or not we can complement that. But I'm also really concerned about how do we manage supporting these kinds of projects when we also have these other large projects coming along, LNG imports or gas lines, that if those projects come to fruition, they may suck up all of the demand mm-hmm. in order to justify and finance their projects, so that these other emerging renewable projects are kind of stuck behind contracts that have to be put in place to finance these other projects. And I see us being, you know, 15 years later, stuck like we've been for the last 15 years, where we can't quite get the demand and the supply in front of each other to advance mm-hmm. what we're doing. And if we want to have more renewables, How do we create the demand that needs it in the case of clean source green energy products? But also, how do you see us trying to navigate the steps forward so that we don't have good projects moving along but then get blocked because other contracts getting put in place?
Chair Holland, thank you for the question. It's very comprehensive, and there's a lot of pieces to unpack there. But let me first say that it really needs to be driven by the market. You know, what we really need is we need a market pull incentive program to get this kicked off. And you're going to be hearing more about that. But we really need, and this term has been bandied around. We've talked about, you know, kind of a ringed fence concept where within a certain area there'd be some sort of an incentive-based pricing program. The Europeans call it contract for difference, that there's an incentive-based pricing program. We think it's really a market pull program to incentivize investment in our industry. Because we are nascent in the industry, and we do need a little help to get to where we can compete, if you will, with other energy sources at their price point. So that's an extremely important component. The other thing around that is, I believe that we need to bring industry to Alaska. We need to be really open for business in a big way. And if we can do that, we can start to use the scale of some of these projects that you've been hearing about from Tuesday's presentations and today. I mean, the opportunity is truly massive, and we have the technology today to deliver this. What we need is we need to build this in a way that it serves a market, it serves a load, it serves a need. And that will also be incredibly important in building an economy for the future. One of the things, I mean, I get really excited about this because now I have grandkids. You know, they're the sixth generation of our family to live in this state, and I hope that our family can continue to live here for multiple generations past that, but we've got to get serious about our economy. And the way we do that is with projects like the governor's envisioning this. He's calling it the Cook Inlet Energy Superbasin. And he's right. We have an energy superbasin, and let's get after developing it. But as I was really, really appreciative of Kelly's presentation, because I think that the National Hydro Association is a great group to help us create the pull, if you will, at a level and work with the state, because they have identified Alaska as this incredible place to do this, at the top of their list, right? And so we're looking forward to really pulling people together. And when you heard from Keith Meyer at HIF Global and what they're looking for, he talked about getting people together. We can do this, and that's what we need to do, is get the players in the room that can actually create this pull. Can create a market, because it's out of the market pull that'll happen. I remember being a kid in 1974 when we started working on the pipeline, and man, when the industry decided they were going to build a pipeline, it was just all go. And I think we're in another place similar to that potentially today if we can put things together in a package that makes sense, and then we can start to bring industry like the HIF Globals to Alaska. There's all kinds of other things, the concept of data centers. I mean, there's one already here in Cordova that's being stood up by GreenSpark, and it's fantastic. It's just the tiniest little start to something that could be really impressive. And so I'm excited about what the future is, and really looking forward to working on it. And it's not going to be without its challenges. This is really serious business, and it's got a lot of hurdles to get over, but we can do this.
Great. Thanks. Just to follow up on that, and I know we've got another question. Who's the we? You mentioned if we can do this. Who convenes? Who leads? How do we move ahead with this? Yeah. Because I think we all have aspirational ideas. I'm trying to figure out where's the lever that we need to push, and who's the we?
Chair Holland, thank you for that question. Super important. I believe personally the we is the industry. I think it's incumbent on industry to step forward and say, this is what we as an industry want to do, and Alaska makes a lot of sense to do this. You've heard a lot about sustainable aviation fuel development. Well, one of the things as a pilot that I'm excited about is being able to fly on SAF, you know, to be able to fly extremely low carbon fuel. And I think that's very real. We're using 1.7 million gallons a day of jet fuel at Ted Stevens International. Mm-hmm. Let's make it here. Mm-hmm. you know, and that's absolutely possible. The answer to your question, I believe, is the we is industry, but industry can't do it alone. We have to build a playing field, and that's where you come in. The legislature builds a playing field and sets the rules so that we know what we're doing and how we're all going to play together. Mm-hmm. But we have this amazing resource. The world needs what we have. Let's figure out how to put it together.
Great. Thank you for that. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you very much, through the chair, Mr. Johnson. You were talking about like a 2050 timeline for a 400 megawatt scale project. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, why that's 25 years out from now? I've got a few things that I sketched out that I thought might be part of it. One, technology maturity, identification of demand or that market where it's going to go. Grid upgrades, it's something that we're dealing with right now. Doesn't help to make energy that we can't bring places, and then permitting and construction timelines. So those were just a couple of things that I was thinking about, and my guess is there might be multiple factors. What's a part of that timeline?
Co-Chair Mears, thank you for that very thoughtful question. One of the things I'm really enjoying this particular presentation today, because I love these kind of questions. I love this kind of dialogue because it makes us better as an industry. One of the reasons why when Steve Colt was doing his development work for his study that came up with the 400 megawatts, they asked us, you know, what do you think you could do and by when? And we really looked at, we know we can see our way forward into the tens and into the low hundreds of megawatts. And 400 just seemed like a great place to go. It's a vision out there. It's a goal out there. We'd love to go much faster if we could. But as you pointed out, Co-Chair Mears, it's going to take the infrastructure to be in place to be able to have that work. But even more important than that, we need the pull. We need the market demand for those electrons to make this all work. And that's one of the things that I really want to focus on is creating that market demand. Because for our project to really make economic sense in the long run, we need scale. We need many of these devices operating. And when we have many devices at scale, we can see the cost of the electricity per electron go down dramatically. If you look at what happened, the cost curves for other renewables, wind and solar, those cost curves have been crushed by scale. And we want to be able to do the same thing.
Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Johnson. So the 400 is sort of like the peak after a ramp up. It's not like we're doing a little bit now and then we'll be able to do the bigger project later. There's like it's implementation of number of pieces along the way, and that's where we finally get to. Is
yes, Co-Chair Mears. That's but I do believe that is a very conservative estimate as to what we could do in the inlet. I'd love to see it be more. But what the more would consist of is we're going to need industry, and we're going to need large industry to be able to do that, because we've got this with this fantastic resource, and if we can get to scale, we can attract industries, and these are things that are going to go on. I mean, the tide is not going to go away, and the cost of the fuel is not going to get any more, you know, and then the price of the technology is only going to get cheaper. So there's a lot of really neat things. And again, I'm excited about this for my grandkids and their kids' kids.
A comment that's part of the discussion that we've been having here is that if we're looking at cheap energy in Alaska for Alaskans, there needs to be more demand. And so some of our exploration that we've had in the committee is what could some of those things be? And something I've been advocating for a while is we need to identify what that can be. One of the things that's kind of bugged me with this work is when we're looking at like a natural gas demand, for example, it's a flat. It's not a curve. It's a straight line. Mm-hmm. And what's the incentive to try and meet a flat line? If we're looking at incentivizing energy production, there needs to be more than that. So some of the work I think we need to do to continue, you know, not just the committee work, but have in a larger sense is identifying what are those other things, not just saying, you know, data centers or mining, but like putting numbers to that and really having a discussion on what is available, because it's harder for those industries to see that and want to be here unless we're saying, hey, this is where we think we are, this is where we can get to. And I don't think we're doing that in a very concentrated way.
Co-Chair Mears, thank you for that comment. That would be my assessment as well. But I think it's time to do that. And it's great. I'm really pleased about this Energy Committee and all the work that you're doing, because I think this is part of the future of our state. If we're going to have an exciting future, energy is really foundational to that excitement, creating that excitement and being able to be real about it. So, I think you're doing the great work that needs to be done, and it's not easy work.
Thanks. I'd like to follow up on that. As we look ahead at the interim that we're going to move into here shortly, we have a period of time where we can continue to do some work. And I'm wondering if you've got some recommendations or thoughts on what can we do between now and January to bring clarity to the demand for the products that could come from a large clean energy supply. And to some degree, it's a leading question, because we know Japan and Korea at this point need all the clean ammonia that they can find. Mm-hmm. We know the hydrogen hub south of us is looking for sources of hydrogen. We know there's a demand coming for sustainable aircraft fuel that we could be selling right now. We know there's a demand for data centers that are trying to find clean, green energy to power their AI systems. The demands are all there. Yet we, have a clarity ourselves of that demand that's right in our Pacific Basin region at this point that would excite us and motivate us. And yet we have a organization that we fund to go sell our salmon and our seafood. We have an organization to go sell our tourism opportunities. We have people that are off selling our natural gas opportunities. How, between now and January, could we aggregate a clarity of the demand that's already there, not someday demand, but real demand now, and bring clarity to what it is and how we could move into it, so that when we meet again in January, we're moving into clarity of the demand and the opportunity, and not just talking about the aspirational opportunity? What can we do in the next 8 months?
Chair Holland, I think you just frameworked what that might be. And I would love to engage. Our company would love to engage in that. And as Keith Meyer pointed out with HIF Global, we need to get together. We need to start talking about what is this from the industry needs to lead. And we need to be the when I say industry, I mean kind of the comprehensive. We need an ecosystem here that has to be built that we don't have. And from the generation folks like ourselves to the users like the Keith Myers and the HIF Globals, to the people that are looking to do data centers, all of that has to be aggregated in a coherent and comprehensive fashion and start moving toward contracts. We need contracts for power. We need to have people with real need that are willing to put money on the line to come to Alaska and sign a contract. And if we can get that, just as they did with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Alaska will be a perpetual energy superpower.
Great. Thank you for that. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Great. Thank you so much for taking time to be here today. It's great to see you again. I appreciate the information you've provided. Thanks.
Thank you.
So a couple wrap-up things here. First off, I want to take a moment to tie up a couple loose ends on the committee work that we've had recently. As sponsor of House Bill 153, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, I want to take a moment and use the co-chair's privilege to speak for a second about where we left off and what comes next with this bill. During a recent hearing, we heard that members wanted to hear directly from the utility, Rail Belt Utilities, and we did invite them here to offer testimony today. But they're not able all to agree that they're ready for that and that they're still working with their boards on those decisions. So we weren't able to arrange that, but we've been working with them. And along with Senator Wilikowski's office, we'll continue that work beyond the session into the interim. And I greatly appreciate the time and effort and input that they've been giving us that have allowed us to develop the version of the bill that we were working on And you'll see in the Senate version that they will be moving in the future to adopting many of the changes that we have in our bill. Their initial bill introduced yesterday was our original bill, but we'll be working to stay in sync with them. At our last meeting on the bill here, we started taking up amendments. And you recall we adopted amendment number 2. And that amendment prohibited the use of ratepayer dollars to pay for the noncompliance fees. However, the amendment also included a broader provision in that it prohibited the use of ratepayer dollars for any renewable energy project that would increase customer rates as utilities work towards compliance. That would include proposed wind projects, solar projects, as well as other proposed projects such as the Susitna-Wantana project. And I wish the same could be said for other sources of energy that we might have that prohibition. And it was because of that realization that that amendment we adopted was essentially going to block any sort of renewable projects moving ahead. And I don't know that that was what was intended with that amendment, but that's what it was doing. And so we suspended the discussion of the amendments at that point while we both undertook the request to get the utilities, but also to understand the consequences of what that amendment would do. And, you know, I don't think that it was necessarily intended that that amendment would create that block on renewable projects, particularly because I think there is broad understanding, particularly on the part of the utilities, that we need the mix of energy. We need the new renewables. We have to figure out how to reduce the reliance on imported gas, and we need to work towards reducing our long-term energy costs. So we're going to continue over the interim to try and unwrap the path forward on that. I recognize that in that discussion there is concern about making sure that if we adopt a portfolio standard and there are non-attainment fees, that there's concern that ratepayers would see those fees. And I understand the pushback on that. But we also need to understand that the new sources of other energy will come about, and they will be, in many cases, as expensive as any of the renewable projects would be. We are fortunate to have the abundant resources that we have here, not only conventional, but also, as we've heard in the last couple meetings, world-class renewable energy potential. It is absolutely unfathomable to realize how much energy we could be producing with power that would last for all generations to come. That power includes 1,100 terawatts. At least of power per year we've seen in the waves and the tidal energy, 200 megawatts of geothermal, 10 gigawatts of underground, wind, as well as the hydrogen storage potential. Just phenomenal. And I appreciate the time and the effort that people have taken to provide the information the last couple of days. It's, I think, fascinating to see that projects like Bradley Lake Hydropower Project, proposed 35 years ago, when it was planned, was four times the cost of the existing rates. And it prompted then that would be approved with a need for an exemption to be able to move that ahead. And yet today we now look at that same project and recognize that it's the lowest cost energy in our grid. Something that we started off afraid of how expensive it was. Even the Fire Island project, I've watched that in the last 20 years start off as this project that we, you know, were critical of because of its high cost of electrical power. Even at its small project scale, it was high cost, but we saw it continue on to be able to power enough energy for 7,000 homes. And while its wind energy costs is more than gas, it's already less expensive than the new Cook Inlet gas contracts, even with the royalty relief. So that project is, you know, again, one that we had this perception that it's high cost, is this beneficial or not? And now we're going to be thankful that it's cheaper than the next source on there. And of course, the projections of future gas imported prices are only higher at this point. So there is no question that we are going to continue to rely on gas for a while for heat and for quite a while, maybe long term, for our power. But gas is already increasing the cost to ratepayers. Recently, the Rail Belt Electrical Utilities submitted a rate filing to the RCA to recover costs from ratepayers for an 8% increase in prices. That would increase the rates to our residential customers by about $100 a year. By 2027, we're likely to begin importing gas at approximately double today's prices. These future costs spanning 15 to 20 years are highly speculative. What is certain is that importing gas will require new infrastructure, including additional storage, and not one, but perhaps two import terminals. And that also means exporting our dollars and increasing our exposure to global market volatility. There is uncertainty around renewable energy. And the discussion we had earlier on the renewable portfolio standard brought about concern about that uncertainty and about the impact it would have on ratepayers. But make no mistake, there is also tremendous uncertainty and risk in the price of natural gas and on our heavy reliance on natural gas at this point in time. So this committee will continue to work on the policy during the interim. I'm looking forward to additional discussions to work on the renewable projects, on the renewable portfolio standard. It's my intention, working with Co-Chair Mears, that we'll continue working on many of these topics that we've been working on over the course of the session. And I'm looking forward to coming back in January, and I hope having the RPS as well as other legislation available at the beginning of the session to move ahead with those. I'm deeply grateful to everybody, including utilities, the members of the committee who have walked through all the different issues we've been on able to look at this point, and look forward to more work in the future. I do want to acknowledge that the committee aide, Shani Kilcoyne, has been here for this session and was a huge help to me, and I hope to many of you who have been able to work with her at the during the session, and I will be missed in the future, but I appreciate that she was able to join us for this session, and I'm very grateful to all the members of the committee for the work that we were able to do during this session. Before wrapping up and concluding this meeting, any other questions or comments? Okay, great. So seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at almost 2:27, but just before I bang the gavel, I want to also say thank you to our Secretary Cheryl Cole, who's been with us the whole time, and Zach Lawhorn in the back. We could not do these meetings without their support and without their patience as they walk through all the material that we throw at them. So anyway, thank you for your time today. This meeting is now adjourned.